Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The president suspended more than 400 public officials for refusing to declare their assets in keeping with the laws of the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission.
Liberia's civil service agency is blocking the salaries of senior public officials after their suspension.
Now this is a new directive that there's a ban on ministers, municipal chief executives, CEOs of state institutions to not fly first class but to fly economy.
Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama imposes a ban on first class travel for public officials.
One of the things that makes me confident is that I know I have what it takes to solve the problem of my people. The second thing is that I know my people are tired of this regime. They are tired to suffer, they are tired to cry without anybody listening.
And Carol Mbako plans to challenge incumbent and long-term President Paul Biya in the coming general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency says the institution has begun blocking the salaries of senior public officials who were suspended without pay by President Joseph Boakai. Josiah Joakai says the president's call for a declaration of official assets is part of his vision and commitment to transparency and accountability in the public sector. It comes after the president suspended over 400 top officials who failed to declare their earnings. It was one of the key campaign promises of the president before the last elections. Liberia's 2014 Code of Conduct demands all public officials declare how much they earn. For more information on the suspensions and their anticipated impact, I reached the Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency, Josiah Joakai.
We see that as a huge action towards the fight against corruption in our country. This is consistent with the president's vision to ensure accountability and transparency in the public sector. The president suspended more than 400 public officials for refusing to declare their assets in keeping with the laws of the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission and the conduct of public officials, the code of conduct of public officials.
So the question is, will this move by the president to suspend all these public officials, even though they have been given a grace period for over a year to declare their assets, bolster the fight against corruption in Liberia?
Absolutely. I mean, there is huge public support for the president's action. And this is a clear demonstration of the president's commitment to the fight against corruption in this country. So this is definitely hugely welcomed by the citizenry. And as Director General of the Civil Service Agency, I am obligated to ensure that the president's mandate is enforced. We have a crucial role to play in that respect. So immediately the president took the action. We wasted no time. We requested our Employment Services Directorate to immediately receive the listing of the suspended public officials from the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission to immediately block their salaries beginning the month of February. And we have done that for spending entities. And so across the 100-plus spending entities, we have blocked the salaries of those officials affected. And I can tell you that we are saving over $104,000 just for the spending entities. I would not tell you how much we're going to save from the 211 public officials in the SOEs, that state-owned enterprises. As a matter of fact, I have written a letter to the head of the Bureau of State-Owned Enterprises, requesting him to immediately block the salaries of those affected officials effective February also. So it's going to be more than 200,000, maybe close to 300,000 total that's going to be saved. And we are working with the Ministry of Finance to ensure that there is an escrow account created to move the funds into the account. And the president is going to let us know what quick impact project that money can be used to implement and realize.
But Josiah, the president and the vice president both declared their assets. Some people said that was a right step to take as an example to other public officials. Why would they wait for over a year to follow the example of the president, or not even follow the examples of the president and the vice president?
Peter, that's incomprehensible. I myself, I don't understand why they had to. And that's not only, I don't see that as being only being disrespectful, but I see that as being, questionable action on their part, because when you declare your asset, you are making full disclosure in terms of what you have, properties and financial resources and everything. So there's a baseline established. People are able to measure what you earn, after your period of service. So without such baseline to know what you had during your entry into government, it's difficult to determine what you earn over the time. So it is questionable that you refuse to declare your asset, then that leads to serious consequences, such as the one the president has taken.
Do you think this will serve as a deterrent and an example for future administrations?
This is exceptional leadership on the part of the president, Peter. Definitely, it's going to serve as a serious deterrence. And people are already, Liberians across the country, the 15 counties, are already talking about that in a positive way. And the president is receiving commendations hugely from across the country. So, yes, it's a deterrent, and people believe that the president is serious about fighting corruption in this country.
Josiah Jokai is the Director General of Liberia's Civil Service Agency. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama has imposed a ban on state-funded first-class travel for public officials. He also directed that all foreign trips should be cleared by the chief of staff. He issued the directive during the swearing-in ceremony of new ministers in the capital, Accra. The move, the president says, is part of his administration's efforts to reduce government spending. It comes as some Ghanaians are calling on anti-graft agencies to investigate allegations of public sector corruption. For analysis and the latest development, I reached Emmanuel Amwa Dakwa. He is an economist and partner at C-Card Global, a consulting firm.
So this is part of the broader policies by the new President John Dramani Mahama to be able to cut expenditure because of the current fiscal condition of the country. So the president promised to appoint just 60 ministers, and also as part of cutting down expenditure for government, now this is the new directive that there's a ban on ministers, municipal chief executives, CEOs of state institutions to not fly first class, but to fly economy. This is part of a broader program for the government to reduce the huge budget deficit and the expenditure of government.
He made this announcement during the swearing-in on some of those ministers who were vetted by parliament. But how did Ghanaians receive this new directive?
Ghanaians are quite happy about it. More importantly, looking at the fiscal position of the country. And also the geopolitics of our country. We know that there have been a cut in aid and there's a gaping funding gap to be filled. And so Ghanaians are quite happy that resources will be channeled to critical areas, especially in the area of health and education. And so Ghanaians are quite happy about this new directive, which seeks to ban foreign travels on first class.
But some people say other countries' nationals sometimes travel on regular economic class. If you think you have more money, you can top up. Some people are suggesting that this should be implemented in Ghana because some so-called rich countries or Western countries have this policy. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I watched the interview of the Minister for Foreign Affairs, and there's a proposal by that minister, Honorable Samuel Kudeto Ablakwa, to look at broad travel policy for both the president and officials of government. And so once such a policy is tabled in cabinet, I know deliberations can go on. But personally, if a minister wants to travel with a first class and he can afford, There is no problem about that. But there should be a thin line between foreign travels and personal travels. This is not the first time a Ghanaian government is implementing such a policy. In June 2018, President Akufo-Addo, the former president of Ghana, also issued a similar directive. But what happened afterwards? So it is not enough to have such a directive. But beyond that, can we have a policy that will streamline foreign travels, especially by government officials?
The question also that I hear a lot of Ghanaians ask is about accountability. Where do Ghanaians stand on accountability or perceived act of corruption of public sector officials?
It is no longer perception because there are evidences to that effect. There is a recent oral committee, that is the Operation Recover All Loot, that has been set up by the government to do preliminary investigation to acts of corruption that happened in the SOR government. But beyond that, there are state institutions like the Special Prosecutor, the Yoko Shraj, the Ghana Police Service itself to look at acts of corruption and how they can prosecute that. I think the fight against corruption, I have indicated in the earlier interviews that the fight against corruption should be an economic policy. Because if corruption is costing us billions of Ghana cedis every year, it should be an economic policy, because once these acts of corruption happen, critical resources that need to be invested in areas like health, education, infrastructure are channeled to pockets of people. And so I believe that accountability broadly, these are state institutions, but beyond the rhetoric of, fighting corruption, we should be able to see action, because a country like Ghana, we have the SY government, there are a lot of reported cases of corruption, but how many of them were prosecuted? And I think we should go just beyond the rhetoric of people engaging in corruption, than just to prosecute people and make it unpopular for people to, engage in this act of corruption.
Emmanuel Amoah-Dakwa is an economist and partner at CECAT Global. He spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Cameroon, Carol Mbakob has expressed interest in challenging incumbent and long-term president Paul Biya in the coming general election. She says the country needs, quote, a mother who has compassion for citizens to resolve the economic and other challenges facing the country. Her remarks come after local media reports that Mbakob is engaged in talks with opposition and civil society groups to seek their support for her presidential bid. But political activists say her candidacy is not likely to pose any threat to the dominance of the governing party, Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, and to President Biya. For more about her presidential aspirations, I reach Carol Mbakob via Microsoft Teams.
Since 2008, I've engaged myself into bring some kind of support to my people. And I discovered that the system is so close that you can really realize the project you are having until either you go on bed with them or either you compromise. And it was so tight and difficult that I discovered the only issue left out is to get into politics and not only being a deputy or a senator, but really aspiring to the supreme responsibility, because that's the only way you can really make some move in the system we have now, because we have some population that have no water, they have no light. This time around, I told myself, and with the advice of many of my fathers and mothers that are seeing me struggling here and there many years now to help them come out of the situation, I was like, okay, you can go for it. We are going to vote you. It's true. To be a woman is very difficult in politics.
What makes you confident? That Cameroonians will, for the first time since the country gained independence, choose a woman to replace incumbent President Paul Biya, who has been in power since 1980s.
Yes. One of the things that makes me confident is that I know I have what it takes to solve the problem of my people. I have it. That's the second thing is that I know my people are tired of this regime. They are tired to suffer, they are tired to cry without anybody listening. And they are ready for any mice to make sure their satisfaction, their life, their dreams come true. So for that one, I thank God because the time is right. Maybe back then in 2011 or 2018, Cameroonians were not ready, but now I bet you they are ready. Like yesterday, I had almost 255 messages for Cameroonians sending their support and their encouragement to tell me to stand to the end because, you know, I wouldn't want to say that men cannot do this. But we had two presidents in Cameroon. The level is not really what we can say appreciable. Now, if a lady can make the change, why not? Because what we want is change. We don't want change through a man. We want change. So anybody that can do it, Cameroonians are ready for it. So I think
Do you think Cameroonians or prospective voters are ready to have a woman president in Cameroon?
I think, and I have proofs, and I'm sure of it. So what I'm going into is to make sure the voters, the Cameroonians, are willing to change this regime. They are willing for Paul Biya and his government to leave. Because if they are willing, they are the one that will do their best to make sure when they go to the voting station or the voting poll, they will vote for change.
But you know, it's very expensive. You know, it's very expensive to run a campaign.
I know.
Who are your financiers? How are you going to raise money to support this? Because as you know, Cameroon is a very big country.
When Cameroonians get matured to understand that a campaign is not the political leader that I am that carries it out alone, then we will see that the money that we invest will be very little. This is an example I'm giving. I told them that even God, when God created the world, God asks to man, I want to build an ark for you. You can bring willing donations. Even God needed help to make sure he betters the life of the people. Come to think of it, we have churches. When the pastor wants to build a church, what will he ask? Can you bring your 1,000 or your 100? And when people bring it, and they will build a temple where they will serve God inside. It's the same way, and I insist, Cameroonians need to get concentrated or need to get this deliverance, this battle very serious. Can you imagine if we are 1,000 people and each of us will give 10,000, that's 10 million. You understand what I'm saying?
That's Do you have people willing to pay that kind of money for you?
I have people willing. The only thing is to organize and to have the good platform, like the platform you are giving to me today. So I'm fighting for the deliverance of my children too, yeah. So, you know, and a mother is best in this kind of war. You men, sometimes you reason with your head. Us women, we reason with our heart. We put in too much emotion, too much heart in what we are doing. So I think Cameroonians, they need a mother right now.
Carol Mbakop is an aspiring presidential candidate. She spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. In Ethiopia, new leaders of the Organization of African First Ladies for Development, or OFLAD, were elected at the General Assembly in the capital Addis Ababa this weekend. The theme of the meeting is Building on Beijing, First Ladies Championing Women's Leadership and Rights Through African Heritage. Officials say the General Assembly brought together African First Ladies and stakeholders to discuss collective action toward social change, with a focus on OFLAD's continued effort to advance women's leadership as well as promoting gender equality in Africa. For more insight on what's ahead for OFLAD and how the organization is working to drive change in Africa, I reach Nados Berhanu via Microsoft Teams. She is OFLAD's executive secretary.
The main thing is to really continue with the legacy, with the former leadership, the former steering committee, and also to really continue with the momentum that has been created so far. The organization is 22 years now. We are now beginning a new strategic framework that is being approved at the General Assembly. So it's the responsibility of the new leadership to make sure that this strategic framework is put in place and really is helping members elevate their advocacy efforts.
Talk to me briefly about this new policy framework that is coming up and what should people expect from this framework?
So the framework basically has the four strategic pillars that the organization has been focusing on for a while now. So the strategic plan for the strategic pillars include health, education, gender-based violence, and economic empowerment. And of course, the framework has also included in it the cross-cutting issues and of climate and peace and security, so that First Ladies can enhance their advocacy efforts in these areas as well, because it really affects all the other pillars as well. And so that's the basic content of the framework. Of course, it's a flexible framework because organizations of First Ladies in their respective countries, the foundations, their offices focus on different issues. The priorities in one country might differ from priorities in other countries. So this framework is offering a generic framework, and it's up to the First Ladies to pick which one is a priority in their countries, and then to really focus on that in terms of developing their advocacy strategy.
So far, with what you have seen, what has been the impact?
So last year, we launched a campaign called hashtag We Are Equal campaign. So this campaign has four pillars that I mentioned earlier on: health, education, gender-based violence, and economic empowerment. And we managed to launch this campaign in 21 countries so far. We have a 22nd country launching end of this month. And so the momentum has been created, as I have mentioned it, in the different countries. And we want to continue with the momentum. So what is the achievement in terms of, there are three things that we were able to achieve as an organization by launching this campaign in these countries. The first thing is First Ladies to support one another. So First Ladies joined their sisters in the respective countries when she's launching the campaign at country level. So this is the kind of solidarity, the kind of sisterhood that we really want to rely on when they are addressing or advocating for an issue at country level. The second thing that we were able to achieve is really having different stakeholders, policymakers, community, traditional leaders, all of them in one room to discuss on issues that affect women and girls in the country. So the convening power of First Ladies to be able to achieve that is a huge achievement, we believe. It's because the event was convened by the First Lady. That is the second thing that we were able to achieve. And the last thing is high level political commitment. So the issues that the First Ladies decided to advocate on while they're launching this kind of countries has been endorsed, if not heads of states, ministers. There were countries where we had heads of states in offline events when we were launching this campaign, and they were committing to support First Ladies and their initiatives, and being able to talk to the different stakeholders in one room when a head of state is doing that, that's a huge achievement, we consider. And if we don't have a head of state, we had the ministers in other countries as well. So these are the three major achievements that I believe have been achieved by doing this.
Nados Berhanu is OFLAT's executive secretary. She spoke with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. In Uganda, a constitutional watchdog is calling on members of parliament from the governing National Resistance Movement, or NRM, not to amend the constitution to allow citizens to face trial in military court. Sarah Biriti is the founder and executive director of the watchdog, the Center for Constitutional Governance. She also expressed displeasure with what she says is the mistreatment of opposition figure Dr. Kizza Besigye, who is facing trial at a military court. It comes after Erias Lukwago, the lawyer for Besigye, called for the case against him to be dismissed due to the opposition leader's health condition. Lukwago says Besigye requires special health care, contending that the prison does not have the equipment to treat the opposition leader. This following the recent Supreme Court's ruling, which said it is illegal for citizens to face trial in military court. Sarah Biriti, who is also a lawyer, tells me Kizza Besigye's human rights are being violated.
There is no case in court after the Supreme Court judgment outlawing the trial of civilians in military courts. So Besigye is being held illegally. He is, you know, being tortured mentally by his prison of conscience. His health has deteriorated. He's gone on hunger strike because of mistreatment. And it's so unfortunate.
But the question some people are asking is, if he decided to embark on hunger strike, which has effectively affected his health condition, then he is to blame, because every prisoner being held is being given nutrition or food. He has refused to partake in the food, which he is now saying is affecting his health.
Well, first things first, the Constitution prohibits any detention of any citizen or a violation of any citizen's liberty without following due process. Kizza Besigye is in prison with no remand warrant. The remand warrant that put him in prison expired on 3rd February. There is no remand warrant. There is no court document keeping Besigye in prison. So we can't compare his condition and his mental health with that of other prisoners who are in prison through due process.
NRM parliamentary caucus, according to local reports, are coming up with a constitutional amendment that will allow civilians to face trial in military courts. Your response to that?
Article 92 of our constitution prohibits parliament from enacting any law to defeat the purpose of a court decision. If parliament attempts to enact a law to defeat the Supreme Court decision, that law will be unconstitutional. It might take us time to challenge it in court, but they will do it in violation of the Constitution.
The opposition in parliament say they will resist all attempts. However, the NRM enjoys an overwhelming majority in parliament, which means that the plan to amend the constitution could be successful in parliament.
Well, we have a precedent in this country under Obote I government. The ministers who made the law for detention without trial were the first victims of that law. And then they had to cry to the constitution and the East African court for their own freedom. So if these MPs have nothing to learn from history, they will fall victims of this same law that they will enact in violation of our constitution.
Attorney Sarah Birete is the founder and executive director for the Center for Constitutional Governance, a Ugandan constitutional watchdog. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. A defense lawyer says charges against the daughter of former Zambian President Edgar Lungu are politically motivated. Tasila Lungu is a member of parliament from the main opposition party, Patriotic Front, or PF. Charles Shangano says questions prosecutors ask Ms. Lungu demonstrate that her legal hurdles are due to being the daughter of the former president, who is seen as a political rival to the administration in Lusaka. His remarks come after Ms. Lungu was released on bond following her arrest. The Zambia Drug Enforcement Commission accuses Ms. Lungu of possession of properties suspected to be proceeds of crime and money laundering acts. She is accused of using improperly acquired money to build farm structures valued at $316,000 on her land in eastern Zambia. Lungu denies the charges. Attorney Charles Shangano tells me that Ms. Lungu is waiting for the state to prove the charges of money laundering in court.
As a lawyer, I can agree with those who say it's politically motivated, because looking at the dates that the framers of the charges are talking about, 2015 to 31st December 2022, this is the period where the former president was ruling this country, Zambia. Now, if you look at the situation, the charges that she has been given, possession of substance under the forfeiture of proceeds of crime act, section 71, definitely this time the land actually in here in Zambia belongs to the president. He holds it on behalf of the nation, and the president is entitled through the commission of land to give someone who applies for land in Zambia. And this property was actually given through a title deed to the daughter of the president, who is Honorable Tasla Lungu. So if you charge someone for possessing land which has title, it's questionable why and how come. How many people in Zambia have held land through the Ministry of Lands under the title of the president's signature?
Critics of the former president are of the view that there's nobody above the law in Zambia, and that if she has a case to answer, she must answer. And people are questioning how she was able to get hundreds of thousands of dollars to acquire that property, which they said is due to proceeds of crime. Your reaction to that?
Yes, according to the law, yes, no one is above the law. But let us look at a proceed of crime. Land cannot be a proceed of a crime if the state has not established that crime. Land is cheap in this country. There is traditional land which you can acquire from the traditional chiefs, and there is state land. Now, this land is under the state land. So what is wrong with the sitting president paying for a land for her daughter? What is wrong with that? Can we say that the president during his tenure was a criminal? No, we cannot say that. So the question that the state agencies were asking related to the father, how she acquired land. She said in her statement, yes, I acquired land, quite all right, you are right. But the payment was made by my father. Is that wrong for a parent to bequeath the daughter, son or daughter piece of land? It is not wrong. Look, for instance, Peter, I will tell you, money laundering. If you purchase animals ranching on that farm, and if you start doing farming on that land, is that money laundering? It's not money laundering according to the law.
After she was charged and released on bond, what happens next in the process?
The next process after she has been released, we are waiting for the state to go and prove into court how she whether that land is out of a result of money laundering. This is what we are waiting. Did the state, the point that I want you to understand, Peter, is money laundering is as a result of proceeds that comes from committing a crime. I want to see how the state is going to prove a crime against the honorable. This is what we are waiting, criminally.
People are asking that should the law that criminalizes or concludes that somebody's property was due to process of crime be amended?
The law should not be amended as such, because I can assure you, Peter, I think I'm a participant in this law, but I think the intention of Parliament here is for you to commit a crime and that you should not benefit from that crime. But here we are talking about acquisition of land legally. How can it come to be a crime? How can it come to be money laundering? How can she acquire this property through a reasonable belief that she committed a crime? What I expected myself is they should have established the crime itself that has caused this land to be purchased, because the money went to the state. When you acquire land here in Zambia, there is no encumbrance should the state give you that land, unless it is acquired by way of fraud.
Charles Shangano is defense lawyer for parliamentarian Tasila Lungu. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Jonathan McReynolds is a prolific American gospel musician. He just won his second Grammy Award last week. This after he featured in the tune One Hallelujah with Tasha Leonard Eric Campbell, Jacqueline Carr, and Israel Helton, which won Best Gospel Performance Song at last week's 67th Grammy Award ceremony. It comes as Mark Reynolds plans to release his new book on February 18, titled Before You Climb Any Higher, Valley Wisdom for Mountain Dreams. The book, he adds, explores the importance of rest and renewal in the valleys of life. The two-time Grammy Award winner stopped by the VOA studios here in Washington for an interview about his win and coming event with me. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
I've seen you play the guitar, but do you play other instruments as well?
Yeah, man. Actually, guitar was the last instrument I ever learned how to play. Mm. I've been playing the drums and the piano since I was like 6 years old.
Wow.
And so, actually, when I first started, my mother used to hate that I started my career with the guitar because I wasn't as good on the guitar. She was like, why don't you play the piano? You've been practicing the piano for a long time. They need to hear that. But now I think I've gotten a little bit better, so she doesn't mind.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So when you coming up with writing songs, do you play it on the piano, the drums, or the guitar?
That's a good question.
When you are
That's
coming up
question.
With it?
Mm-hmm. I always tell songwriters, try to do whatever causes the least limitation.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's often singing something a cappella first.
Okay.
So before you even pick up, because once you start going to an instrument, now you're subject to your limitations there.
Mm.
And if you only know four chords there, then now your song is just gonna have those four chords. So I try to write a good portion of the song just in my phone, just singing into the voice memo. And then after I've gotten that, then I'll go find an instrument and see which one works best.
Mm.
I probably start with guitar mostly, but recently I've been kind of falling in love again with the piano, so.
Ask you, what are the prospects of a gospel Grammy Award winner? What are the prospects? What are the opportunities that come as a result of winning such an award?
So I think it always comes particularly in the marketplace, the mainstream marketplace. They don't know all the things of the church. They don't know the gospel awards all the time, or they don't know what's playing on gospel radio. They don't know what the praise team is singing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say I'm a Grammy Award winner, there's a certain level of respect that they give it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always helpful. It just helps us tell the story. Obviously, we don't live trying to get awards, but it does help us kind of tell the story in places and worlds that they're not really accustomed to kind of the details and the intricacies of what we do.
February 18.
Yes, sir.
It's a big day for you.
It's
Talk
huge.
To me about it.
All right. So I know you know me as a musician,
mm-hmm.
but I'm actually releasing my second book February 18th. It's called Before You Climb Any Higher, and I'm so excited about it. It is a book about really learning to be successful, but not consumed with success.
Mm.
Learning to climb the mountain, work hard, grind, but never forget who you are in the valley.
What inspired this book?
My own life, man. Just being burned out, succeeding and other people, applauding the Grammy and the TV and everything else, but still kind of being depressed and anxious and lonely myself. There had to be something I was disconnected from, even though I was doing so well.
Mm-hmm.
I was working so hard, and I was missing out on the relationship with just my Father in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy that we can sing about God and still sometimes not be with him.
Mm.
We can do stuff in his name and for him, but not with him. And so I had to make sure that I stopped my climb and kind of recalibrated, reoriented myself with the valley, I call it in the book, where there's actually life, there's actually the presence, there's actually identity as a son or daughter of God.
What would be the major takeaway of anybody who reads this second book? We'll go to the first book, but let's focus on February 18th.
No, let's talk about the second. Let's go.
All right.
No, yeah. It's okay to be the boss, the king, the head of state, the teacher, the man, the husband, the wife. But please know that on your best day, that still is not as good as just being a son or daughter of God.
Mm-hmm.
Your identity is in that, and that can never be taken away from you. and you don't have to earn it. So make sure that that's where you live from and not one of those titles that you've earned along the way.
So when a bird whispered to me that you have some relations or connections to the African country or West African country, Ghana, talk to me about it.
Absolutely. First of all, it's just the most beautiful people that you're ever gonna find. Just beautiful people. I, in November, became a dual citizen. So now I am American, but also Ghanaian, and I'm so proud. Shout out to Princess Okansi and the entire Okansi royal family. They really caped up for me and my mother and my sister, and we as a family joined the Ghanaian family. And we shook hands with the president, and we just had a really amazing time integrating into our first real experience of being home. And it's just amazing what Ghana has done to extend themselves out to the diaspora all around the world. And I'm just grateful to be one of that number.
So when you came back,
yes, sir.
What were some of the feedback you got from your friends here? Said, so, well, you went to the motherland, they say.
Oh, yeah. Well, they want to come.
Okay.
They want to come. They you'd be surprised how the black community in America, we miss our family in Africa. We don't even know what to miss all the time, but we know that there's a part of us that's over there and that we can't wait to integrate. We can't wait to re-meet everybody. We can't wait to hug. We can't wait to learn the languages that we once knew. We can't wait to eat the food that we once ate, you know what I'm saying? And so, you know, they're jealous. They want to come with me next time. And so next time I go to Ghana, I'll probably have to bring 10 people over because they just really want to, man, it's just different. It's something about putting your feet on the soil, hugging a tree, that everything in your body just kind of comes back into some sort of alignment because it is truly home.
Jonathan McReynolds is a prolific American gospel musician and a two-time Grammy winner. He spoke with me from here in Washington. Business analysts say employees appear to be less enthusiastic to return to the office full-time and may do anything to avoid going back. They also say employees are willing to even accept a pay cut of about 20% to be able to work from home. It comes as one report says office occupancy has hit a post-pandemic high of 54%. Mark Lascola is a workplace strategy expert and the founder of the group called On The Mac, which did the occupancy survey. He has also redesigned over 500 workplaces and has trained 5,000 executives worldwide. He talks to me about what the requirement to return to work full-time means for employees who have become accustomed to working from home.
For anyone returning to work full-time, including federal employees, it's a hard pill to swallow, and it makes it difficult for them because, as I talked about, there's a lot of work that can be done from remote locations. And again, I think the dictate of returning to work for federal employees is a mixed bag in that, number one, it's really trying to get a handle on who's on the team, who do they want to get rid of. But I think there's another issue, just the pure psychological challenge that comes with losing some freedom and being able to work from home is a big, big psychological challenge for employees to come to grips with that. And my guess is part of the motive for doing that is to have people leave the federal government to challenge some of the employees, say, as you can imagine, some people are going to go, I don't need this job. I'll go look for a job elsewhere. And I think that's part of the motivation. But you're going to see that in any industry when they're required to go back to work full time on site every day. I think you're going to see that challenge.
Now, Mark, experts like you say people support what they help create. How is collaboration improved by a return to work?
Well, nobody works independently. Meaning their work impacts other people. And if you just look at workplaces, they're not designed to be like a car engine where there's a spark plug and you can just replace a part and then the engine keeps running. Workplaces have interdependencies with other parts. And so the importance of collaboration in the workplace is about ensuring people are connected and can work together and really understand how my work impacts other people's work. And the importance of that collaboration, you also have to remember, Peter, that we're social creatures. We're not just designed to do tasks as human beings. And so the importance of connection, the social capital that comes with working together is very critical in terms of productivity and commitment. Now, the other fact that you should be aware of has to do with loneliness in the workplace. People in today are reporting more loneliness than ever in their lives. And of course, we're more connected now than ever through social media, but that is really not about real psychological connection.
Why is it so important to have collaborative processes in businesses? Collaboration, probably some argue, improves when you are in person. Why?
Yeah. Well, Peter, let's go back to the in-person thing, which is, you'll completely understand this. With me talking to you now on the phone, you're not seeing my face. You can kind of hear my tone of my voice, and you can hear my voice go up and down. And so you're catching some of my communication. But we know that over 70% of communication between two people happen through nonverbal expression, my facial expressions, looking in my eyes, hearing my voice, getting a sense of who I am. So number one is a lot of our communication, Peter, happens through nonverbal means, the majority of our communication, which is why at some point texting and messaging and having a chat on the phone about a task is okay sometimes, but it's not enough by itself. And then the importance of collaboration at work is no one works on their own. For example, you know, I am part of a team that works on projects, and what I do on my team impacts my colleagues. So the importance of communicating, the importance of staying aligned, what we call alignment, the importance of connecting and staying on the same page, whatever metaphor you want to use, these are all critical elements of having a workplace that is both productive and effective and efficient. And without that, it's just not going to happen. It's not going to work well.
Mark Lascola is a workplace strategy expert and the founder of the group called On The Mac. He spoke with me from Phoenix, Arizona. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection. But first, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah. I don't wanna hurt anymore. Moyo si mama when you call in my phone. Niki tazama, oh no, I'm not alone. And I'm feeling at home, but my loving be so low. Daily be thinking about my Caribbean. Oh yeah, yeah, she part of me. It's not alarming me that we still building up this chemistry. So don't you mess with she. I got some angels in my love for this positivity. So don't you get up on my temper. I got some fire inside, who, and I'm next up. And you don't believe who. Catch me in a few years, few gears. Who hears your Allah and the man up in the mirror. So let me get a little bit of clearer. Can you see me? Nitizame kwenye kiyo. Una pendeza ukijistiri na mtandio milio. Ndani nitajizi kojo kwa.
Oh my temper, temper.
You got my feelings, you hurt my feelings. Reason I don't really wanna stress no more.
You doubt my feelings, broke my heart, so I never really wanna see your face no more.
Cool my temper, out of my place.
pressure. All the way I'm feeling, cause I'm feeling vibration. Baby, motivation, not in my amper. So I need a fresh one, I really wanna step up. Baby, like you're feeling me. Baby, on your body, you go dancing me. Shady, who you feel like you're holding me. I don't wanna dance when I'm feeling this, yeah. And I don't wanna hide anymore. Even if I find love, not anymore, yeah. I don't wanna fight anymore. Running for your love, might wanna start a war. It on my time, but I waste no more. Yeah, I don't wanna fight anymore. Fighting for your love, might wanna make a war. And I'm not falling.
Cool my temper, 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 temper. Cool my temper, 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 temper. Cool my temper, 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 temper. Cool my temper, 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 temper.
It's given very much to Papa.
I miss you bad. We dey fight, don't mean say make we break up, oh. That is to say, baby, make we no give up, oh. You dey my mind anytime where I wake up, oh. Yeah, and I dey beg, baby, make we make up, oh. Yeah, take off, I cheat where you cheat, where I cheat, where you cheat back, baby, make we cancel that. Take off, I cheat where you cheat, where I cheat, where you cheat back, baby, make me dance to that. I don't feel like I did you wrong, that be why I didn't sing this song. Loving you is all I want, I just want to let you know, man, I miss you bad.
Suppose, cause I don't know how I'm getting home. It's been so rough. Couple days on the road, couple days in the same clothes. Baby, I've been so drunk. Thinking about touching your body. Girl, I know that you love me. So it's a dry eyes. Memories can't tell me the lie. Girl, how many times must I apologize? Yeah, kill, I'm on me, yeah, kill. Hit me, gon' go, need back.
Take off, I cheat where you cheat, where I cheat, where you cheat back. Baby, make me cancel. Take off, I cheat where you cheat, where I cheat, where you cheat back.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Mogbill Yabaro, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the little opportunity given to a monkey to wear clothes does not guarantee it to join the dining table. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.